So we don't have fall seasons in the part of India I come from. It's either green, raining, or it's dry. So this is something very spectacular, you know. I think this area is very special, Ontario, for fall colors. I recommend that, you know, you go out often and enjoy the colors. So next 3 weeks, including this week, we will be discussing about statistical mechanics. If you look at the syllabus as given in the website, it focuses on phase transition and critical phenomena. Statistical mechanics is a very important core course. In addition to this very fascinating phenomena, there are many other basic aspects, which is very current and important in terms of research. So I will spend some time broadly, and we will have at least about six lectures on, or six or seven, on phase transitions and critical phenomena. I will try to cover a broad spectrum of topics. I looked at the previous speakers, starting from Leo Kadanoff, the master. He has his own style. It was very enjoyable to see how he switches topics and how he discusses things. Then we had John Berlinski focusing on phase transition, critical phenomena, and Anton Burkow also focusing on phase transition and critical phenomena. I will follow some style. You know, you will see at the end how good it is. So in today's lecture, I will, to keep like a roadmap, I will give some introduction. Then we'll talk about emergence. And there is a very delightful article by P.W. Anderson with the title "More is Different." I will explain this in some detail. And then about fluctuations. In macroscopic variables. How they are nearly absent. And then talk about entropy, temperature, and heat. So this is what I plan to do today. And I have an Indian accent, South Indian accent. Sometimes I tend to speak very fast, so please don't hesitate to stop me. And I have got an introduction to you because Debbie gave me this sheet of paper where I have your photographs. So people from all over the world are here. I think almost all the continents are represented. Yeah. Very nice meeting you. And okay. We all learned thermodynamics in our education, and it's a remarkable subject that started by some engineers, Carnot and Joule and many others. So beyond Newtonian mechanics that was known at that time, or beyond electrodynamics that was known at that time, people started thinking about remarkable regularities in nature, predictable behavior of macroscopic objects. I'm not talking about planets, or I'm not talking about sun, but simple things like you can take a beaker and have some gas filled in there, or you can have liquid like water. And these are all, you know, objects that behave in a very predictable way. And at that time, people realized already that they're all made up of atoms and molecules. There were no direct proof, but there was good indication that they were all made up of some objects called atoms and molecules. So somehow these macroscopic objects behave in a very predictable way. Except for clouds, you know, when you look at the cloud, clouds, after a few minutes, they change their shape, it does something. But anything else that we see, of course, we keep moving. In our time scales, objects look very predictable and very rigid. So these giants were thinking about a simple gas and trying to build steam engines and other devices, actually started introducing new notions to describe. Because at that time, what was known was basically notions that come from Newtonian mechanics. For example, temperature was an intuitive notion, but these giants quantified it and gave a scale and defined a variable called temperature. Then in a very mysterious way, another quantity was introduced, which is entropy. It is mysterious because there was some compulsion when people were making measurements in thermodynamics that there is some form of useful energy, some form of useless energy, which you cannot extract. So they introduced the concept of entropy. I still don't understand how they landed on this concept, because as we will see, this is a very clear connection to microscopics, that is, things at the level of atoms and of those dimensions. That is, a dimension of configuration space, a dimension of phase space, captures this notion of entropy. Somehow, based on phenomenological grounds, they introduced this beautiful idea. And then, of course, heat. So the whole edifice of thermodynamics evolves around these phenomenological variables. And heat is energy, so this is something that we know. And also, we have to introduce a notion of work done. For example, you can compress a gas or expand the gas and make it do work. So these basic ideas were there. And then, of course, pressure, which is again related to force per unit area. And then density. For simple liquid and gas, these things are sufficient. So there was a very beautiful relation between, for example, pressure, density, and temperature. Very sharp relation. This is what we call as equation of state. That is, let's say, density and temperature. So it defines there's some function which vanishes in equilibrium. So in equilibrium, there's a very special relation between pressure, temperature, and density, for example, in the case of a gas. So this was a phenomenological fact. Then very quickly, people like Maxwell and Boltzmann and others tried to rationalize it based on dynamics of atoms and molecules, which is part of this whole game. I will not touch upon thermodynamics at all, because it's a very beautiful subject. Lots of things are there. We will not touch thermodynamics. But we will do statistical mechanics, which gives a microscopic basis for this phenomenological theory, namely thermodynamics. And we all know that there are three laws of thermodynamics, first, second, and third law. First law is basically conservation of energy. Second law says that you cannot make heat flow from a cold to a hotter place, as simple as that. Third law says that, comes from quantum mechanics, so-called Nernst theorem, which says that the limit the temperature goes to zero, entropy should vanish. And there are beautiful exceptions to that when you come to quantum physics, including ice. We will discuss it at some point. So this is about thermodynamics. Now, as far as thermodynamics is concerned, you can say this concept like entropy, it's not a mechanistic. It's not part of Newton's laws. It's not part of electromagnetic theory. So this new notion was introduced. So you can say this is an emergent property. We will see meaning of this, more of this. Then it turns out, if you look at physics on the whole and going down to biology, physics is full of this phenomenon of emergence. It's good to appreciate that because as physicists, we are started seeing even more complicated emergent properties than simple ideal gas or non-ideal gas or liquids. So it is here I want you to look at this article by P.W. Anderson. He has a paper in Science magazine. You can freely download it. If you just do a Google, more is different by Anderson, you can see that. So a very nice article, Science magazine in 1973. He has two aims. We will not bother about the first aim. Anderson was a, you know, it's a towering figure. And in those days, my good friends from higher energy physics were calling the field that he was involved, namely solid-state physics, as something applied and not exciting intellectually and so on. So it's a rebuttal to that. So I'm not focusing on that. What I'm focusing on is his showing that science is hierarchical. And we will just see what are the hierarchies. For example, you start seeing part of the hierarchy in the field of thermodynamics. So one field where you just see part of the hierarchy. And if you look inside, you see wonderful things happening, which is what I will try to demonstrate. Then if you go beyond, new things emerge, including inanimate matter. See, finally, when you are able to talk about liquid, gas, and some phase changes, solids, and so on, if finally we are all made up of atoms and molecules, we may not like to go to very complicated questions like consciousness and so on, but behavior of an amoeba, a single cell organism, we should be able to comprehend and using known laws of physics and new emergent properties, we should be able to understand them. So this is where the hierarchy becomes, at least to appreciate that there are hierarchies is very important. And Anderson gives many, many examples. So let me first talk about a very simple emergent property, which will be, in fact, occupy us quite some time, that comes from simple liquid and gas. If you look at the phase diagram, for example, of ice, you'll find that it is something like this, approximately. Temperature. So here you have gas. So I'm talking about, let's say, H2O. You have water. And you have ice. It's a very simple phase diagram. This is a famous triple point where water, ice, and gas coexist. Along this line, you have evaporation of ice into vapor. Now, you can say that laws of thermodynamics is an emergent phenomena that explains this phase diagram. And when you come to ice, it's a very rich phase diagram. For example, as you go to high pressure and low temperature, there are about 12 phases of ice. And also ice in smaller size, like nanoscopic dimensions, for example, in our cell, have very peculiar structures, which is not part of this crystalline ice structure, which are very functional, which are very useful for understanding many, many biological phenomena. We will not go into that. So today, what I'm going to focus as one of the emergent properties is this. This is called a critical point. That is, if you are at any point here, water and vapor coexist. They have identical free energy. However, when you cross this line, there is a change in density. But if you follow this line, the change in density will vanish at the so-called critical point. So this is a point at, so there is a TC, and there is a critical pressure. So in principle, I can go from water to gas, for example, along this trajectory. So there is nothing different. Uniformly, the density is changing, and water or vapor is as disordered as you can imagine, or you can say it's as symmetric as you can imagine atoms are moving around, molecules are moving around, you see some uniform phase. But however, if you go close here, something remarkable happens. The system is deciding to go between water and gas, and there is a critical phenomenon. In fact, this critical phenomenon is usually introduced with the concept of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which we will come to. But before that here, obviously there is no symmetry breaking because water is as symmetric as gas. But however, there is some physics that's going on which is bringing us to this point. This is called critical phenomena. What is special about it? For example, if you manage to take water to that particular point, and then you will find that it looks milky or turbid. The reason is very simple. At that particular point, there are fluctuations in the density at all scales. It's a remarkable consequence of, it's an emergence which nobody would have anticipated. Suppose you have Newton's laws alone, using them and thinking deeply about it, about number of atoms following Newton's laws, you cannot predict existence of a state called critical state. And how do we characterize it? We will see that they are characterized by so-called density-density correlation functions. That is, suppose I take water, it has some, at this point, it has some mean density. Let me call it as rho naught. Then, at any point, I can imagine a density. Then I can take another point. Let's say I do some kind of time average experiment. That is, I measure the density locally at some point, and I measure the density at another point, separated, and then do some average by repeating the experiment at different times, do some time average, or I do ensemble average. What you find is something remarkable, that this quantity has no scale. That is, normally, if you find something fluctuating here, they will be correlated at short distances. But when you move farther away, they will be uncorrelated. So normally, you expect them to behave like this. That is, fluctuations about the mean value, they will not be correlated. But here something remarkable happens. It is as if this length scale, which is called a correlation length, diverges, and you are left with some power law here, which is here. So this is a very simple looking phenomena. This is called a critical state. And in fact, we'll be occupied for several classes a model called Ising model, which illustrates this critical state in a very quantitative fashion. In fact, the whole development of renormalization group and various beautiful things started from critical state. It's even more than that. It is this critical phenomena which made people like Polyakov, one of the heroes in high energy physics and string theory and so on, to think about this critical state more closely and come up with something called conformal invariance. And to do mathematics of that, you have so-called conformal field theory, which you can safely say was the beginning of string theory and so on. So a very simple emergent phenomena that happens in a simple thing like liquid vapor system has led physicists to come to very, you know, later, very deep developments in completely unexpected domain. In fact, that's one of the great things in physics. A deeper understanding in some domain often has ramifications elsewhere in an unexpected place. So this is one of the beautiful emergent properties. Now it goes beyond what I have been, because I'm talking about equilibrium phenomena. There is a notion called self-organized criticality. In fact, this notion came from people trying to understand deeply the critical state. For example, in the critical state I'm talking about, will be there if you take a piece of ferromagnet. It's a completely magnetized iron. And then keep heating it, spins will start fluctuating. At a particular point, magnetism will just disappear. And there, if you look at it, the spins will have correlations which behave in a power law fashion. So there are many, many examples. So this is an equilibrium phenomenon, particularly Per Bak, who is unfortunately no more, an old friend. He said, many systems in nature, it could be living system, it could be economic systems, or it could be population dynamics. Many systems in nature tend to have this kind of behavior, particularly interesting systems, like living systems. That is, you keep yourself always critical, because that allows you to progress. You are not settled down in any minimum state. So this is called self-organized criticality, a beautiful notion that came from trying to understand one of the consequences of simple thermodynamics. In fact, while Maxwell Boltzmann did not have an idea about this critical state, the first idea came from van der Waals. We will discuss it, in fact, in the next lecture. You all know the van der Waals theory of liquids. So it's a very simple modification of ideal Bose gas. You can call it as a phenomenological modification. That led to existence of a critical point. And then using that, and you can go beyond, you can deduce such critical behavior. But however, one of the biggest thing is the value of this particular exponent. It turns out these exponents depend on whether your liquid and gas lives in three dimension, or is it form a two-dimensional layer or one dimension. And that's related to the phenomenon of universality and so on. I will not go into it. But this is very interesting, because people now look at many, many dynamical systems, as I said, like finance market, or it could be aircraft trafficking in North America. There are many, many situations which are related to a self-organized critical state. So there is no scale to things. So there can be surprises. There can be new emergent properties. And I just learned while preparing for this lecture, because I heard about earlier, that if you look at precipitation and rain and vapor pressure or the humidity, apparently there is this, it's a critical state. Because I come from India, where you have monsoon. So people have analyzed the fluctuations in amount of rain temporally and spatially. Apparently, this entire weather system related to monsoon rain is in a self-organized critical state over several decades. See, here I have the distance r minus r prime can start from few nanometers, go to millimeter and centimeter. Here in this weather system, talk about several hundred kilometers down to meters and below. So something that started, you know, in a very simple way has ramification in weather predictions and so on. Okay. So this is one simple emergence that when you think about liquid and gas. Now, if you come to ice, you can discuss several such emergent properties. I will not go into it because I have to cover other things. So I will focus on going beyond simple liquid and water. What else is there? For as I said, when you come to ice, it's a periodic structure. So you say that translation symmetry is broken, because ice forms some HCP structure or some complicated thing. And then if you take ice to very low temperature, you find that water, which carries a dipole moment, starts ordering in some particular way. So there is a tendency to become ferroelectric, but it doesn't manage to become ferroelectric because of quantum fluctuations. So there are lots and lots of emergent properties. I will not discuss it. The thing that Anderson emphasizes is that, for example, this phase diagram can tell you about what keeps us busy in normal statistical mechanics. Ordered phases, some idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking, liquid gas, and critical slowing down when you go here. But there are other things happening. For example, a very simple phenomenon of polymer formation. It turns out, if you think about living system, polymers play a fundamental role. We have proteins, we have DNA, and we also membranes play a fundamental role. So you notice that one-dimensional structure simply like polymer, and then two-dimensional structure, membranes. In fact, polymers can be formed in reactions. You can synthesize polymers. Most of them come from living material. Then membranes, you can create a soap bubble and make it thinner and thinner. That's a membrane. But then you go to our body, we have cells where there are lipid bilayer membranes. And it turns out, when you go from simple gas to liquid, these things possess very important thing, which is beyond a simple crystalline order. For example, if I talk about crystals, I have crystallographic classifications of various crystals, space group, point groups, and so on. Then I know how to go from one to the other. But when it comes to a one-dimensional systems like a DNA or an amino acid, in addition to this fact that you have a linear polymer formation, there is a new thing called information content, which is not there in any of the things that I discussed before. There is not much information content in water or in liquid or even in crystalline ice. Whereas if I have a DNA, even if I take the humblest DNA of E. coli, some simple amoeba, it has 50,000 genes, so various gene sequences. And what do? They do wonderful things. They do replicate, they create life, and so on. So just the same atoms and molecules that formed water or any other liquid and solid, suddenly if you give it an opportunity to organize, they organize into these one-dimensional structures like polymer, and completely new notion starts coming. In fact, that insight came from Schrodinger. Schrodinger is well known for Schrodinger equation. He's also well known for inquiry into life. There is a book by Schrodinger called What is Life? So he worries about and thinks about statistical mechanics and wonders what kind of modifications I need to push the statistical mechanics that I know to start thinking about life, not necessarily making quantitative predictions. He came up with two important notions. One is he hypothesized that as you go from inanimate matter to living matter, there should be aperiodic crystals. Aperiodic crystals. Once you see aperiodic crystals, you can imagine like a DNA with a particular gene sequence. So now we know, with all the modern developments, that they carry information. They are like the blueprint for what to do next. So there is a whole machinery that goes behind it. But Schrodinger, early in 19, some years after he discovered Schrodinger equation, he suggested that information people were looking for after the famous work by Mendel and so on, there is something called heredity. There is something that carries this information about heredity. He hypothesized that it has to be embedded in some one-dimensional aperiodic crystal. So if you look at famous books in biology, like genetics, the first page will contain Schrodinger's hypothesis that he long back hypothesized that genetic information should be contained at the molecular level as a one-dimensional sequence. So this is a very important thing. So this is what Anderson points out, that a new set of rules, a new, that is, give enough time for matter to reorganize itself, it will create protein, it will create RNA, DNA, and so on, and then new things starts happening. So this is far from the thermodynamics that we know, but however, it's on the way to new things. It's not very different. You can, in fact, do some modeling of some of these things using known thermodynamic laws and so on. Then the second thing that Schrodinger did was notion of negative entropy. So here the basic idea is that in non-living system like a gas and liquid, you have learned in thermodynamics, the system wants to maximize the entropy given the constraint that is in some heat bath. Whereas we all realize in living systems, it works very hard by taking energy from outside to maintain some kind of order. And so he says that it's throwing out entropy. So this notion is called negentropy. So this was again hypothesized, starting with known laws of thermodynamics, how to modify them to incorporate life. Of course, these two notions are alone not sufficient to understand life and various things. But this is the kind of directions that many people are taking. And in fact, today, I routinely look at the archive. You all know about this. In case you have not, it's a remarkable repository where people in various fields, condensed matter physics, string theory, quantum physics, upload their recent work in the form of preprints. In parallel, they submitted to journals also. So in my field, you find about 30 papers every day. I spent about half an hour looking at it. And the truth is, I don't read newspaper these days. Whatever news I know about the world is from friends. This is my newspaper. So today there is a very interesting article, precisely about, it has a very strange title, What Did Erwin Mean? I didn't know what, he is talking about Erwin Schrodinger. So he's elaborating the old ideas of Schrodinger in the modern context. Okay, so now in order to understand simple phenomena like this water, gas, liquid, and crystal, you have beautiful ideas of spontaneous symmetry breaking, order parameter. We'll discuss these things later. Now, when you go beyond this, there will be more things which we do not know right now. In fact, I will just at that point, I will digress a little bit and talk about a little bit it's an active field, frustrated what I mean is the following. If you take a liquid or a gas, they are very happy. You have some very simple state. But then when you have very complex things like a living system, you notice it's very frustrated. It's trying to do this, it's trying to do that, it's trying to remain critical, it organizes itself, disorganizes itself. So glass is a good example of frustrated system. For example, suppose you take a window glass. You can ask the question, can I imagine configurations in which this window glass will have lower energy? The answer is yes. There must be, in fact, there are theorems, I believe, which show that the minimum energy configurations are ordered crystals, for example. But glass, somebody has formed it, some glass former, so it got stuck there. It may flow to a crystalline configuration, but it may take time which is beyond the age of the universe. So they become meaningless questions. So there are many, many statistical systems like glasses and many other living systems where things are struggling. And in fact, a famous example of glassiness is a protein. Now, this is again very important in biology. Protein is a sequence of amino acids. Maybe there are 300 amino acids. And what is the lowest conformational state of a protein, which is very important for life. How does a biological system find its way to have the right conformation? And if you look at the physics of this, turns out there are many, many possible conformations with very near free energy. So you say it has a glassy landscape. Somehow it goes towards that. So there are statistical mechanical systems which are not as simple as liquid or gas or a simple crystal. So there is a whole field of equilibrium statistical mechanics studying frustrated systems, which is a very active field. And frustrated classical system, frustrated quantum systems. So statistical mechanics has got expanded. Now we are attacking more complicated problems. And also, I say that whenever we do this kind of statistical mechanics, we are in the comfort zone of equilibrium statistical mechanics. We talk about time average, and we talk about things which do not change in time. Equilibrium statistics, already that's very complicated. Beautiful notions are coming. Now, once you move away from equilibrium and go to non-equilibrium phenomena, things are much richer and more complicated. We don't have a statistical mechanics of that particular phenomena yet. It's for young people like you to develop that field. There are many, many things happening. Even taking clues from equilibrium statistical mechanics, there are fantastic things happening. Just since I'm first lecture is an introductory lecture, if I have time, I'll talk about it later. There's something called Jarosinski inequality, which is supposed to be a revolutionary development in the field of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, but uses notions from equilibrium statistical mechanics. So all kinds of things are happening. So here what I wanted to say is thermodynamics is a simple, like a tip of the iceberg emergence. When you go deeply look at things, there are many, many beautiful emergent properties all waiting to be explained using the laws of physics that we know and finding new laws on the way. Okay. So this covers half of what I wanted to say. Now I will talk about one thing that I missed. I had probability theory. You have all learned probability theory, elements of it. You know about events that have no control, in our control. So we see statistically things happening. So we try to rationalize and give some probability distribution for it, the time of elections, or it could be something else. So probability theory is a very, very useful mathematical tool, which has its own limitations, but however, it's very, very powerful. In some sense, Maxwell, Boltzmann, and others introduced probability theory into the field of thermodynamics, trying to rationalize thermodynamics. But however, the probability theory that we deal here is very special. This is something that I wanted to point out as part of the introduction. We'll talk about probability theory. The phenomenon of time causing is very, very well-known experiment. And in fact, what you learn from time causing, or so-called binomial distribution, is very useful to understand so-called spin system. We will come to it. You have already some idea about it. But in statistical mechanics, we are talking about very peculiar probability distributions because the degrees of freedom involved are thermodynamically large. So in any other place where we use probability theory, normally there are finite number of variables which we are worrying about. Here we have essentially infinite number of variables. For example, if you study spin system, there is a cubic lattice, and at every site there is some quantum spin or a classical spin. It talks to the neighbor. So when I want to calculate statistical averages of such system thermodynamic average, I deal with a probability distribution in which there are Avogadro number of spins. Or if I discuss a liquid, There are Avogadro number of variables. The phase space is very big. So this largeness brings in very peculiar consequences of probability that finally whatever we measure becomes extremely sharp. And it is the same probability which goes into many-body theory and field theory. For example, if you write down the wave function of, suppose I have a simple model of a harmonic chain. There are masses, atoms with mass m, and they are connected by some spring constant, so k ui minus ui plus 1 whole square. So this is a potential energy. I sum over all, then I have a kinetic energy. So you must have all solved this quantum mechanical problem. It's a harmonic chain. And if you have a periodic boundary condition, you can diagonalize the problem using Fourier transformation. And at the end, you will find normal modes. You say that these interacting atoms forming a simple harmonic one-dimensional chain is decomposed into normal modes. Then in the ground state of this harmonic chain, every normal mode is in the ground state, namely a Gaussian state. Now, I leave it as an exercise. If you write the ground state wave function of harmonic chain in terms of the variables, namely displacements, what you will find is so when written down in terms of real displacement, the ground state wave function looks like this. This probability theorist will call it as a multivariate Gaussian distribution. We are all familiar with a very simple Gaussian distribution with some normalization constant. Here you have many variables, they are correlated. And this is the kind of thing that we come across in statistical mechanics. So this is the kind of thing you come across in quantum mechanics in many-body theory. And when you consider thermodynamics of that such system, you have something like this. And if you consider field theory, for example, if you look at the electromagnetic vacuum and write down the wave functional of the electromagnetic vacuum, it will have some form like this. A will be some vector potential at another time, some w r minus r prime. That is, this quantity gives you the probability amplitude of finding a particular configuration of vector potential. So that's a very simple Gaussian. So this is the kind of thing that we come across in quantum field theory or in simple quantum many-body theory. And this is the kind of thing we come across in statistical mechanics. And we often invoke law of large numbers while trying to understand statistical mechanics, because there are many, many degrees of freedom involved. So they all move and they have erratic behavior, but the mean behaves in a very meaningful and a sharp way. This is also related to so-called central limit theorem, that if you look at sum of, let's say there are n random variables, each one, let's say, distributed according to some distribution, let's say uniform distribution or some other distribution, and then this sum, when the number n becomes larger and larger, will have a very sharp Gaussian behavior, with the width becomes narrower and narrower as square root of n. This is well-known central limit theorem. So all these things are very useful when we discuss liquid and gas. But when you come to statistical mechanics of interacting system, simple central limit theorem is not useful, because many new things, even which probabilists did not anticipate, start happening. And that is related to so-called phase transition. Even probabilists did not anticipate phase transitions and also critical phenomena. So this is a new phenomena that's happening even in probability theory, because there are a large number of variables organized in some lattice, and they are correlated in a way that probabilists are not used to in other phenomena. So that's what brings in cooperative behavior. Just to give you one simple example, Suppose I have a square lattice. In fact, we'll discuss this problem at length. I have some magnetic moment at every side, which we normally denote by a variable Si. So you all know that if you take a real magnet, a magnetic moment here will communicate with a neighbor through what you learn in quantum mechanics called exchange interaction. For example, there will be, depending on the system, they may like to be parallel or they may like to be anti-parallel. So the energy of this system, as far as this degree of freedom is concerned, is very simple. The energy function is, in fact, this will be the famous Ising model that we will discuss at length later. So there are spins which communicate with each other. And they are very happy if the spins are parallel because I gain an energy minus J. So it's a very simple, classical looking problem. Now, if you look at the probability distribution of this, as told by Gibbs, which we'll discuss later, Gibbs said that a thermal state when I put this bracket, it means nearest neighbor coupling. So this is a famous Gibbs distribution. So the probability of finding the spins in some configuration is this, divided by normalization factor. So this is a famous Gibbs distribution. And something remarkable happens when the temperature is very high, spins are disordered, things seem to follow a law of large numbers. And what you find is, if you ask the question, what is the probability that I will find some value for so-called magnetization? I'll call this M. So I have a probability distribution function for a large number of variables, namely spins in a lattice. So if you take a cubic centimeter of lattice, there will be Avogadro number of spins. So this is the sharp probability distribution function, exact. And we want to calculate now some observable. So in particular, I want to know how does the total magnetization behave as a function of various parameters. So this is just the sum of this random variable. Central limit theorem tells you that if the random variables are not correlated, this probability, let me call it as a small p of m, you have a very sharp peak around m equal to 0. So this will be exponentially narrow. It will go 1 over square root of n. But the peak will be around m equal to 0. So what does it mean? It means that the correlations between spins, as expressed by this, doesn't matter at very high temperature. It looks as if they get correlated, but beyond some length scale, they break apart. So they behave as if there is no cooperativity. So this is something which probabilists will appreciate, standard probability theory. But something remarkable happens when you go below so-called critical temperature, which we'll discuss at length. This probability distribution function splits into two pieces. And this is a very simple example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And in fact, before all these things came, people doing probability theory never knew this phenomena happening in probability theory. Because now, here, the mean value of this object has a very sharp, good meaning, because everything is fluctuating about some mean value, which is 0. Here, the mean value is 0. I have a probability distribution of this variable m, which is picked around some value. Let me call it the m naught, which will be, of course, a function of temperature minus m naught. The mean value is indeed 0, but it's meaningless. Because even though this is where we have to be very careful. There may be distributions in which the mean may be 0, but most of the action will be happening here and here. And here something remarkable happens. Now if you take this system and give it a little bias, then immediately you will find that this distribution collapses. Basically, if you bias in the positive direction, this essentially vanishes, leading you with this. So this kind of singular things happen in probability distribution is unheard of in the standard probability theory. So statistical mechanics, when we view it as probability theory, has many surprises, many new phenomena. In fact, the whole development of renormalization group that I was mentioning about can be thought of as a development in the field of probability theory. There are also papers discussing that. Okay, this is a little bit about probability theory. Now let me talk about it's a very small illustration, but I would like you to appreciate this by doing other similar examples. Suppose I take a gas in a container of dimension L. So there is some density. Now I want to find out with what probability the entire density will have a value which is not the density that I'm talking about, but slightly smaller value. And another way of saying is, what is the probability, for example, that all the atoms in this gas will come to a smaller volume spontaneously? Because in principle, when you think about a gas, atoms are moving around. So there is a chance that all the atoms may crowd in this corner. So I'm not even asking that kind of, I'm saying that what is the probability that there will be a small, collectively they will contract. And it's very easy to show that if you take a single atom, the probability of finding it in this length is 1. Now it will be 1 minus epsilon, because I'm going to find it slightly 1 minus epsilon. Right? Then there are n such atoms, where n is Avogadro number. You find a very simple question that what is the probability that the density as a collective variable will deviate from whatever value that the mean value it had, let's say by 1%. And what you find is it is a small to the power of n, where n is Avogadro number. So you will convince yourself that the probability of that happening is astronomically small, 10 raised to minus 100 and so on, or Avogadro number, billion. So this is a remarkable thing about, so I have told you about density. You can do the same thing for ideal gas, because you have learned in thermodynamics, an ideal gas is the one in which the momentum of the particles are random, but there is a value of the kinetic energy, which is fixed by the temperature. So you can find out what is the probability of temperature fluctuation or kinetic energy, internal energy fluctuation in a given volume. You'll again find its exponential of some Avogadro number. So this is the reason why we see the macroscopic objects that we see around us, be it a liquid or gas, does not undergo big fluctuation because the numbers involved are Avogadro number. But however, when you go down in size, you will start seeing fluctuation. That's what Einstein saw, or Brownian motion. That is, if you start seeing objects at the level of microns, they will undergo fluctuations, which reflects fluctuations happening at that scale in the liquid or gas. So in the standard thermodynamics, we are in a comfort zone where there is no fluctuations. Whatever we calculate using laws of thermodynamics, the equation of states and so on is very nice. But when you start making measurements, when you start looking at samples of small size, fluctuations will come. In fact, hopefully this is what we will do at the end of the course. In one lecture, we'll discuss about kinetic phenomena and the fluctuations, how it is related to what you measure in the lab. This is also something very important. Statistical thermodynamics was driven by experimental phenomenology. But in the last several decades, very sophisticated experimental measurements can be done. For example, you can do neutron scattering in a system which is in equilibrium. Or you can do current voltage relation, which is an old thing. You can measure conductivity, or you can measure thermal conductivity, and a variety of things that you can do. Finally, they are all done in equilibrium systems. So there should be a way of calculating those quantities in a given equilibrium system. And that is related to so-called fluctuation dissipation theorem. That is, if you calculate transport like property like resistivity, it contains information about the nature of fluctuations at whatever time scale that you are probing the system. So that is just bordering statistical mechanics, equilibrium statistical mechanics, that is related to Boltzmann equations and kinetic theory and so on. We will do it at the end. Okay, so this is a little bit about, please think about it. In fact, if you go to Landau and Lipschitz, he makes some statement about this kind. That is, I take a microgram of liquid and then find out how much, what is the probability for internal energy change. Again, it will turn out to be some exponential of minus of Avogadro number. Things like this. So that's why the nature we see around us at our time scales, at our perceivable time scales, that is very stable and there is no fluctuation. So I have covered most of it. Now let me finish with this. So this is a very nice, for example, it's discussed in Landau Lipschitz or in book by Patrick. By the way, I'm not following any particular book for whatever I'm doing. There are good books available, like there is nothing like Landau and Lipschitz's Statistical Mechanics. It's a fantastic book, but very terse. He does things in a very practical way, avoiding complicated mathematics, extremely physical. It's a great book, but very terse. Then there is a book by Patria, Statistical Mechanics. In fact, Patria was a professor in University of Waterloo. Now he's in San Diego. And Huang, Statistical Mechanics. And in the website, there are, you know, wonderful resources, Wikipedia and so on. So what I'm going to discuss is to get some idea about entropy and temperature from a very simple, what we will call as microcanonical. So here, it's a very nice discussion given in various books. So here I have, let's say, some classical system. So there are N1 particles, and there are N2 particles. Then the energy is given sharp. So we will call it as a thermodynamic system. And then in order to characterize that, we need something called omega 1, number of microstates. For example, if I'm doing quantum statistical mechanics, what I will say is that I have an isolated system which has a sharp energy epsilon. What I will do is I'll count the number of eigenstates in a small interval around that energy. So called density of eigenstates. Whereas in classical statistical mechanics, for example, this omega will be the volume of phase space. Because it turns out energy is conserved. Suppose I have a Hamiltonian, which is conservative. There are no time dependences. Particles have kinetic energy, and they have some two-body potential. Then energy is a conserved quantity. So these are all functions of the momenta and the positions of the particles. So this is equal to constant for an isolated system, and in particular, it's equal to E1. Now, if I go to the 6n-dimensional phase space, this defines some hypersurface. So I will take the volume of the hypersurface to be omega 1. It's as simple as that. So there is some hypersurface in which energy is constant. value of energy is E1, and then I take this volume. So I take two such systems. So at the moment, they are not communicating. There is no energy transfer between them. And so in the microcanonical ensemble description, which you will see next class in detail, this specification is sufficient to give you all the thermodynamic information. So using now some thought experiment, you will get information about entropy and temperature. So the discussion goes like this. At the moment, they are not communicating. Now I bring them together. And I do not, for example, I have some membrane which doesn't allow particle to pass through, but however, they can exchange kinetic energy. They come and collide. So N1 will continue to be N1. But now, since I'm exchanging energy, E1 will become, could become different, and E2 could become different. But however, the sum has to be the old E1 plus E2. Again, exchange energy, total energy is conserved. Now the question is, what about this? So we will just use one fact, saying that once the systems combine, then the energies will be shared. And I do not know, N1 is in remaining constant. I don't know about this omega 1' and omega 2', because I have this energy surface. Now we will have two energy surfaces, one corresponding to this energy, another corresponding to this energy. So what is the criteria which will tell me that I have a new equilibrium state? Because you agree, these are all mental experiments. There is no serious, in fact, this is a kind of thing that Landau and Lipschitz does, that suppose you combine them together, there will be some transient phenomenon, there will be some chaos. At the end of the day, there will be some relaxation time, and everything will go to some equilibrium. Because these two are, they were isolated system, not communicating with the rest of the world. Now they communicate among themselves. There is some molecular chaos, there is some interaction. Finally, they settle down. And then, what are the values of omega 1, omega 2? So it's a very simple criteria, which says that the product omega 1 prime and omega 2 prime should become the largest. That is a condition for equilibrium. Please think about it. Once you do that, now you know you have a very simple relation. You have this volume of phase space. Because otherwise, I mean, you can ask a question, what else could it be? Because there is nothing else available. Energy is shared. So energy can be shared in many ways. It should be shared in such a way that this product is maximal. Now, if you do it mathematically, immediately you will find some expression for what we call as entropy, and then also expression for temperature. So the statement is, so you call it as, I will not, just simple algebra. At the end of the day, what you will find is, just please do it for yourself. You find at the place where it is optimal, evaluated at the optimal value. So this gives us immediately a definition for entropy. And then 1 over T is I've not done it completely, but please do it yourself. It's fairly straightforward, keeping track of the notation. You're just coming from the condition that the product is maximized. That immediately tells you that for the two things should be the same, provided what we call as temperature are identical. In equilibrium, they have identical temperature. That also brings you the notion of entropy. So today I will complete with this. And then in the next lecture, I will go into the idea of phase space, Hilbert space, and Liouville theorem, and getting this canonical, grand canonical, and microcanonical distributions, and defining general partition function. Then I will quickly go into phase transition theory. OK, I think I will close today. And any questions? The last one I did not, I had my symbols wrong, so I didn't do it complete, but it's fairly straightforward, just two lines and do it. So the most important idea is that when the systems start communicating, something should be optimized, that's like a postulate. And that optimization is a product of the volume of phase space here and here. There are many physical explanations for saying that in equilibrium, the system will explore as much phase space as possible. It's a consequence of that. That's this postulate. Okay. There are no questions. We'll meet tomorrow. There should be some questions, right? Probably, let me ask a question. Are you familiar with most of these concepts? Like this derivation, which I did not complete. How many of you have done it? OK, then at least half. So please do it. It's fairly straightforward. And about fluctuations, how many of you have worried about it? That is, fluctuations of macroscopic variables. That is indeed very small. Is it taught in? OK. Thank you.